Part of the main news headlines we just heard there is that there are some astronauts up in space, some amateur astronauts, as they're describing them, put up there by Elon Musk, who wants to send 1 million people to Mars by 2050. And now is the time to talk about Mars while we still have the opportunity, what we want to do with the planet. So no better time to discuss Simon Morden's excellent new book, The Red Planet. And Simon joins us now. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, everyone.
Yes, a lesser broadcaster, of course, would have played Is There Life on Mars by David Bowie, but I'd resisted. You know, you'd be glad to hear.
Excellent news. I was expecting something by Jeff Wayne, to be honest, but there you go.
That might have been more appropriate, absolutely. It really is the time to talk about Mars, and I must confess, as a bit of a space freak myself, you know, I was young enough, old enough, however you look at it, to sit up and watch the, you know, man land on the moon. And I just find it extraordinary that we've got these vehicles up there now and little helicopter flying around. It's quite a time to be alive, isn't it?
It's frankly extraordinary. I mean, I am also of an age. I was 3 years old when the moon landings happened. I was sat in front of a television by my parents at the time. Obviously, I can't remember it. I wish I could. But no, the space race seemed to have cooled off a lot. And in the last few years, it's suddenly kicked off. It's magnificent. There's a lot of work going on, a lot of good work too. And the discoveries we're making are groundbreaking. I love it. I think it's a great time to be alive.
I love the story about you, and I hope this is true and not an urban myth, that you ordered a piece of a meteorite from NASA's collection when you were a young student, and you'd just completed a doctorate on the magnetic properties of meteorites, and you decided it was quite boring and just kind of forgot about it and decided to do something else instead.
Well, I mean, the thing about the meteorite, NASA has a basically what we call a big book of meteorites, and you can literally write off to them and say, I'll have some of that to do some work on.
Wow.
And the meteorite that I ordered was just sort of like an average piece of rock, and when I got hold of it, it wasn't any good for the research I was doing. I just put it to one side. I did some tests on it, and nothing was coming out right. It was just a rubbish piece of rock for what I wanted. And of course, inevitably, 6 months later, someone says, it's not a rubbish bit of rock, it's from Mars.
Yeah. How amazing.
Like, I was so annoyed. I could have called it, and I didn't.
So tell me, I'm fascinated by NASA's book of meteors. So can you only get that if you're researching then, and you kind of and you pay for it, and then do you give it back afterwards? How's that work?
I was working at Newcastle University at the time, doing my first postdoc, and yeah, but basically it's a big catalogue of all their meteorite finds that they hold in their collection that are available for researchers. It's all free. You don't have to pay for any of it. You write to them with a proposal saying, I want to do this to this piece of rock, and it goes in front of a committee, and they either tick the box or put a big X in it. And you know, a couple of weeks later, you get a big jiffy bag through the post.
Wow.
And it's got meteorites in it.
How extraordinary. I'd love to see the insurance claim that if Royal Mail lost that and you filled out, where did it come from? It came from Mars. Oh, dear.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally priceless. If they'd realised it had come from Mars when I ordered it, I would never have got within 100 miles of that piece of rock.
Goodness.
It's beyond value.
How extraordinary. Well, it makes looking through Freeman's clothing catalogues really quite boring, doesn't it, I would guess, having looked through that one. Oh, dear. Now, I didn't know until I started doing my research on this that there was something, and I ought to know this, it was signed back during the Cold War in 1967, and it was called the Outer Space Treaty. It was ratified, unbelievably, by all the countries who were spacefaring, and amongst other things, they said that no one country can own an extraterrestrial object in part or as a whole, and all of outer space is held in common for the benefit of everybody, and that one slipped slipped past me, I must confess, but I'm glad we got that one in early.
Well, I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of legislation. If you imagine sort of back to 1967 when you know, people were facing each other off across the Iron Curtain, and it was basically done in order to prevent people putting nuclear weapons in space.
Yes.
The extraordinary thing, obviously, is that you think, well, you've got a few minutes between, you know, Russia and America launching their nuclear weapons at each other, and to be able to detect the weapons coming across, and that's how we ended up with the theory of mutually assured destruction.
Yes.
But if you have nuclear weapons in orbit, mm-hmm. you can literally just drop them on. It takes bare moments, and people were rightly terrified of that prospect. So they made a treaty, and whoever was writing the treaty managed to get in. Well, what happens if we decide to go to the moon and then we put nuclear weapons on the moon? Can we launch nuclear weapons from there?
Yeah.
Let's do something about that. So they wrote this treaty, and I don't think they quite realised how important it was going to be.
Sure.
Long after the Cold War had finished. The fact that we all own space collectively together.
Wow.
I think that's a lovely idea, and I think it's one worth keeping hold of.
Absolutely. Hence why I brought it up there. What an extraordinary thing. Am I making it up that people used to sell plots on the moon? Was that completely legal then?
No, I mean, yes, people used to. No, they had absolutely no legal standing whatsoever. I mean, it's like trying to buy bits of the sea.
Yeah,
it's just you can't do it. It's not allowed. And there is a United Nations treaty saying that you can't do it.
Goodness me, how interesting. In my other day job, I'm a songwriter by trade, and in some of the contracts I've seen, including ones from Simon Cowell, the song copyrights extend not only to the Earth, but to the solar system and the known universe. So they've got in on the act as well. Delighted to see.
Well, I'd like to see which parts of the unknown universe he's more concerned about here.
If you're thinking of doing a gig in outer space, you're stuffed, basically. Right, so let's talk about Mars, the main subject of the day. And to say Mars has been through it a bit would be an understatement, really, over the 4.5 billion years since its formation. It's been through the wars a little, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, it's a planet of wild extremes. The early formation of Mars was completely scuppered by the presence of Jupiter,
right.
That seemed to suck most of the mass out of the inner solar system and everything else beyond it as well. Jupiter is as big as a planet can possibly get without almost turning into a sun. The effects that it had are simply just astonishing. So Mars is undersized. It's tiny in comparison with Earth. It's a third of the radius, and it's only a tenth of the mass. So it's quite a small planet, and it's just scarred. It's got no atmosphere. It's very cold. The soil's poisonous, and it's sleeted by radiation. I'm not quite sure why we want to visit it, but I think it's very much a question. It's because it's there.
Yes, it sounds very much like the second born child. You know, where the first child gets all the good stuff, and the rubbish is left for the second one.
Yes, let's not talk about Venus.
Well, yeah, it's a very good question, why we want to go there. I had the fascinating experience of interviewing Dr. Robert Zubrin, who formed the Mars Society, who are the very influential advocacy organisation, I'm sure you've heard of them, dedicated to the settlement of the planet Mars. And he sees Mars as just kind of one early step in a kind of major expedition out towards the solar system. So I suppose we pick it because we can, as you say.
Yeah, There are advantages of going to a planet in that if you're just working out in space, gravity is a real bonus. Because basically it just keeps things where you put them. That's the real advantage of a planet. If you can't keep things in one place in orbit. So going to a planet and being able to have a solid surface which you can put structures on and dibble around and mine raw materials from is a genuine bonus. Like I say, Mars is a genuinely awful place to go, though. It certainly wouldn't be anybody's first choice of a first colony. But with respect to Zubrin, if we can do it on Mars, we can probably do it most places. There aren't any technical reasons why we can't go to Mars, why we can't build a colony there. There are a lot of ethical considerations to have, though.
Yes. It's obviously, it goes without saying, a long way away, so any human beings that set off there would have quite a trip on their hands, and as you say, when you got there, you've got to take quite a lot of stuff with you that you can't manufacture from Mars, but you can do some things, can't you, with what you've got there when you arrive?
Yes, for sure. The obvious thing is water. Water is exceptionally heavy, and you can't compress it. I mean, if you freeze water, it actually gets larger. So it's one of those things that you look around and you think, well, if we can save on carrying all of the water we need for a year or so, then you've got a massive weight saving. And in space travel, weight is fuel, and fuel is cost. So there are parts of Mars where you can literally just dig it out of the ground. You can take a shovel outside and stick it into the soil, and whatever you dig up is about a third water.
Right.
It's all in the form of ice, of course, but you take that inside and heat it up, and you've got all the water you need, which is great. There are a few other things as well you can do. You can make fuel from what is left of the atmosphere. You can crack the carbon dioxide to make oxygen.
Yep.
So there are plenty of things you can do, and you can just use the soil as well, for that matter. The lack of magnetic field on Mars means that the surface is quite hot in the radioactive sense. A lot of the solar radiation gets through. So burying your home under a huge pile of Mars dust is certainly one of the things that we could do to protect any potential colonists.
In terms of humans living and working there, then I'm guessing we'd have to come up with something like Biosphere 2, where everything is under some huge glass dome and we're growing our own plants and creating our own oxygen and all the rest of it. Quite an engineering task for something that far away.
Again, yes. The real problem is that you are at the far end of what is essentially a 9-month supply chain. Even if you have a rocket on the launch pad ready to go, it takes about that long to get to Mars, wherever in the orbit it happens. And as we suddenly discovered over the last couple of years, that any disruption in the supply chain leads to empty shelves. You only need one ship stuck in the Suez Canal, and suddenly everything just grinds to a halt. It's really quite astonishing. So if you end up with that part has broken off and we desperately need it, you can't wait 9 months to get it. Either you've got a spare or you're going to have to make it yourself. And obviously, one of the things about going to Mars is, can we survive there? Can we actually do all of the things that we want to do there in order to survive? And that will the first thing that we need to take over, almost before we decide to start growing food or anything like that, is how do we manufacture material out of what we've got there?
Yeah, I mean, hey, just hearing you talk about that supply problem there, it makes the toilet rolls at Tesco during the lockdown pale into insignificance, doesn't it, really?
Well, it's you know, I when I go and do my weekly shop, there are still gaps on the shelves. But I remember sort of, you know, desperately running around the shops in March 2020.
Yeah.
Searching for toilet rolls and phoning up friends and saying, well, you know, if I was on Mars, I mean, how much more difficult would that be? The amount of work that actually goes into making a single toilet roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's astonishing. And you know, even toilet roll on Mars, how would that work?
Yeah, it's a fair point. I've got this kind of picture in my mental image at the, you know, that Jeff Bezos has already got Mars down as an Amazon drop-off point somewhere, just ready to press the button.
Well, I imagine Ocado will probably get there first, but there you go.
But they'd only turn up with half of the stuff and you'd have to get them to go back again. Yes. Now, let's talk about these brilliant things which are sitting as we speak on Mars. NASA's Perseverance rover, for example, which arrived in February. Just extraordinary feats of engineering and technology. I mean, I've tried flying a radio-controlled helicopter on Earth. Frankly, it's almost impossible. So trying to fly one on Mars must be just really difficult. But what brilliant technology. Have we got three rovers still on Mars? Is that right?
Yeah, so the Chinese have got one,
yep.
And the Americans have got two.
Yep.
The Europeans were supposed to have one, and unfortunately, we managed to plow it into the surface.
Of course, yes.
Which is slightly.
How ironic!
Shame. but you know, we can always go again. The likelihood of actually getting a lander on Mars these days has actually increased. At one point, we were just literally making craters with almost every single attempt that we had. But the way they do it now, mainly, is through having a almost like a flying crane.
Right.
Which they get close enough to the surface, and then they just sort of lower the lander down on a wire, while the crane bit itself is hovering on rockets above the surface. The way we used to do it was basically just throw whatever we had at the ground and hoped it worked.
And
more often than not, it didn't.
Mm.
So the fact that we've got three landers working on Mars at the same time is progress. It's definitely progress.
Absolutely.
And Europe, the European Space Agency are going again in a couple of years' time. So hopefully they can get it to the surface this time.
And presumably when it gets there, they'll presumably have to take a PCR test.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should say that. So, there are protocols. You know when you see spacecraft being made and everyone is standing around in a very bright white room, all wearing, you know, white clothes, and they've all got face masks on and everything like that, and always have done. It's not to protect the spaceship that they're launching. What it is to protect the place that the spaceship is going.
How fascinating.
So there are very strict planetary decontamination rules, so that we don't inadvertently send our germs to other places.
Yeah.
So when you know, Perseverance landed, it is possibly the cleanest, most sterile object, far cleaner than anything you would get in a getting an operating room in a hospital. It's probably the cleanest object ever sent into space.
Goodness me.
Simply because we don't want to carry any of our bugs to Mars.
It makes total sense. And I'm guessing that Grant Shapps would be more than happy to put the red planet on the red list. I mean, that's the only one that would justify it completely, isn't it?
Well, there is also the problem of, well, if we have samples being returned from Mars, what do we do with them?
Yeah.
Do we put them in quarantine? Do we decontaminate them?
Yeah.
What are the chances of accidentally introducing a terrible disease from Mars to Earth that we have no defence against?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that brings me, I guess, to my final David Bowie question. Is there life on Mars? What have we discovered, if anything? Or are we just basically hoping against hope?
Well, it's an easy question, and there are lots of complicated answers to this. I would argue that there probably isn't life on Mars now, but in the past there probably was, when conditions were better. Mars in the past was a lot warmer and a lot wetter than it is now. The whole northern hemisphere of Mars was a vast ocean, and volcanism, volcanoes, undersea vents and things like that were exactly where we found life on Earth first.
Yes.
And those were exactly the same conditions that would have been found on Mars, you know, 4 billion years ago. I think that there was life on Mars. Mm. I don't think there is now, simply because if you look at Earth from space, we can see that there's life. It's everywhere we look.
Yeah.
If we look down on Mars now, we see nothing.
Mm.
And if there was life, we would see it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the Isle of Wight. There are places exactly like that there as well. So it's been absolutely brilliant to talk to you. We could talk all day. It's such a fascinating subject. But let's go and get people to go and get your book, which you can get from our website, tre.radio. The book is called The Red Planet, A Natural History of Mars. Simon, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about it. Been a real pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Very welcome, Bill.
All the best. Cheers. Take care. All the best. Bye-bye.